Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Atlanta Legal Experts Radio. I'm Emily Rowell with Peachtree Offices and your host here with Ryan, with Rich Casanova in the building, and Ryan's also here, too, in the background.
It's the R&R show, and Emily, our superstar talk show host, welcome to the Atlanta Legal Experts. We're very excited. We have a great lineup this morning.
We do. We're going to get right down to it, too. Okay. We have Robert Hendricks with Morgan & Morgan this morning. He is an accomplished trial lawyer who has recovered over $20 million in benefits for his clients in over a decade of practice. Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you so much for being here. And coming up later in the show, we have David Lee Windicher with Aurora & La Scala. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Good answer, yeah.
He knows firsthand about criminal. He's a criminal defense attorney, and he knows firsthand about criminal law, a former gang member who survived the streets to eventually become an attorney. So we're excited to have you here this morning, David. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, so this show has been brought to you in part by, we have a whole list today. Of sponsors, actually.
Well, I would be a sponsor if there was a room
you
on the
are.
List.
Yeah, you we are. A sponsor. Peachtree Offices, 3A Law Practice Management, Atlanta's own John Marshall Law School, U.S. Legal Support, Golden Pair Funding, and Equitable Payments.
Wow, look at you.
Thank you.
That's some big news. Some additional sponsors to the show.
Yeah, I'm really
welcome
excited.
To those folks.
Yeah, thank you. And you can find the logo and the links to their site. To their websites on our websites at AtlantaLegalExperts.com. So great. Let's get started. I will start off reading Rob's bio. Rob Hendricks III is an accomplished trial lawyer who has recovered over $20 million in benefits for his clients in over a decade of practice. He focuses his practice almost exclusively on representing injured employees in workers' compensation cases. He has tried cases in nearly every corner of the state in front of nearly every administrative law judge. Rob is currently heading to the Columbus, Georgia office of Morgan & Morgan. In addition to Rob's trial accomplishments, he is also an experienced appellate advocate. Hope I said that right. He has handled numerous matters through the appellate process, including at the Georgia Court of Appeals and Georgia Supreme Court. Included in Rob's appellate advocacy is the reported case of DeKalb Board of Education versus Singleton in 2008, which was landmark in that the decision allowed for an injured employee to receive income benefits for a psychic injury only after the physical injury resolved. So that was a big thing. We'll probably talk about that in just a minute. And he has been recognized many times for his skill as an attorney. For four straight years, 2010 through 2013, he was named Georgia Rising Star Super Lawyer. He takes his obligations to the law very seriously and is active in the legal community, serving in leadership positions at the local, state, and national level. He is a frequent lecturer on the local, state, and national level as well. He has given presentations at every major legal conference involving Georgia workers' compensation law. And I have a whole list of all the other things that you do, but you guys that are listening can actually see that entire bio on our website at AtlantaLegalExpertsRadio.com. I do have some time with you, but I'd like to talk to you instead of sit here and read this for another hour.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I thought so. So listen, tell me how you got to where you are today.
Well, actually, I look back at my old high school football program and said I wanted to be a lawyer. And then when I was in college, I was trying to decide what to do. And my family persuaded me to go to work for State Farm so I could take over a State Farm agency, which was my grandfather and uncle, both State Farm agents in Tucker, Georgia.
Okay.
During that time, I went to work for State Farm, and I was doing workers' comp claims and some other types of claims. Mm-hmm. And I was dating this girl who actually talked me into going to law school since I was managing so much litigation with the intention to defend the insurance carriers. Once I got out of law school, I did that for a few years, and somebody asked me to come join them representing employees, so I did that, and I joined Morgan & Morgan about 3 years ago.
Oh, wow. So you're relatively new with Morgan & Morgan.
Right.
And you run the Columbus, Georgia
Correct.
Location.
Yeah, which handles all the services of Southwest Georgia, basically.
Gotcha. So, yeah, so you followed your passion and your girlfriend's advice.
Yeah, then we broke up, and I married a school teacher.
So. Wonderful. Well, let's talk a little bit about workers' comp. What is workers' compensation, and is it the same in all states?
Workers' comps really is a big system of trade-offs, and I'll give you a little foundation of it. It was implemented in about the 1930s. what had happened was is that people, and it was kind of a perfect storm of events that led to it in the early 1900s, which is you've got a lot of people working for other employers instead of working for themselves. You got a lot of dangerous jobs, dangerous conditions, a lot of people getting hurt at work, and people really don't have access to medical care. So the effect of it was is you got employees who are injured. They can't get medical treatment. They can't get better. They can't get better. They can't get back to work. And then they lose their income and basically lose everything.
Sure.
The employers had a couple problems, which one is replacing people every day results in your HR department's bigger than your company. The bigger problem was is that the employees looking for some kind of help would sue their employers in what we call tort. And tort is basically an intentional act or negligence that results in the injury. In the work injury context, that's not the situation. So you had employers that weren't happy because they couldn't win either way. They're either paying lawyers a bunch of money to fight lawsuits, 90% of which should never have been filed. And then in other situations, when the employer was found to have done an intentional act of negligence, they get sued, they pay lawyers a bunch of money, and then they pay a jury verdict that counts for pain and suffering, consequential damages, special damages, punitive damages, consortium for the family. So workers' comp was implemented to be a system of trade-offs, basically. So the employees got a major advantage, which is the employer, it became a no-fault system, and the employer agreed to accept every injury as long as the magic words are, did it arise out of and during the course of employment, mm-hmm. with, of course, some defenses and exceptions like positive drug screens, independent contractors, where they horseplay and stuff like that.
Sure.
The employers got three big advantages. One is they eliminated all the tort remedies. They eliminated the pain and suffering, consortium, special damages, all that sort of thing. And the second advantage is that you can no longer sue them in tort. The employer gets exclusive remedies. So in other words, they don't have to be concerned about paying out big jury verdicts that account for a lot of those remedies. And lastly, they get to limit which physicians those employees receive medical care with.
You know, nobody has ever explained it like that to me before, and the history like that. That's really good to know.
Well, I guess the second part of your question, is it the same in all states? And it's not. Each state implements their own set of laws, and they are vastly different. And when I attend these national conferences, you know, we're all kind of shocked at each other's laws. And and that's important because a lot of times, and I have it with my own clients, is that there could be several states that could have jurisdiction. And some states have advantages as far as the medical care, but less so when it comes to the income benefits. So especially what I see is a lot of truck drivers who, I have one, but there's four potential states that could have jurisdiction. The employee is supposed to get the option of picking, and sometimes that happens and sometimes it doesn't. I see some employers that try to do what's called venue clauses, where they want to limit the employee to a particular state, which is not valid in Georgia, but a lot of times end up spinning some wheels doing that. But each state's very, very unique, and especially where I practice now in Columbus, you got a lot of people who live in Alabama, work in Georgia, and a lot of people come over the line and stuff like that.
So you have to know the Alabama law, obviously, as well.
Enough to give them some advice.
Right, yeah.
Fortunately, there's a lot of attorneys over there that are willing to help out when you ask.
But when they work in Georgia, they have to go by the Georgia, obviously, the Georgia laws as far as workers' comp goes.
Well, it depends on the basis for jurisdiction. There's three different bases in Georgia. Okay. One is if the incident occurred in Georgia, then that covers it. They could have Georgia jurisdiction even if they're an employee of another state. The other thing they'll look at is the principal place of business of the employer. And that would come into play, for instance, if I had a Georgia employee who's doing work in another state. And the last one is where the contract to hire took place. And that can be a little tricky. I mean, the slam dunk one is where the contract was accepted. So in other words, if you've got an employee who was in the state of Georgia, they called him up and said, hey, do you want to come work for XYZ company? And he says, yes, contract of acceptance takes place in Georgia. Other ones, especially with truck drivers, where they have to pass a DOT physical and all that, they may have been in another state, but then they've got to come to Georgia to actually finalize it and, you know, meet all the requirements.
Okay, so got it. So wherever they were when they took the contract.
Correct.
Then that's where they have to. Okay. So what are the employee's rights?
The employee basically gets three things. And like I said, they eliminate all the tort remedies, and that's usually the biggest hurdle I have getting clients to understand is, no, you can't get the pain and suffering. You don't get paid for what you've been through and all that. Workers' comp is designed to do three main things, which is provide medical care, pay them income while they're out of work, and pay them for whatever permanent deficits they have to the body. So, you know, a lot of people are so used to seeing the things on the news, and like the McDonald's coffee is always the one that the first things people talk about. In workers' comp, it's really designed to give the employee enough care to make their condition where they can return to work. It's meant to be a transitional thing. It's not meant to compensate somebody or, you know, for what they've been through, but they take care of your medical care. They pay you the income benefits. I think the biggest myth I have is that's all economic. So a lot of people think that's something to do with the significance of their injury. And to give you an example, I had a client who had a construction accident and was paralyzed.
Oh, no.
And he didn't get any workers' comp income benefits. And so people say, oh, my gosh, that's terrible. But aside from the injury, it was kind of a happy situation. He learned enough about the construction business working in the field where the company liked him, and they allowed him to come do the business in. So he wheels his wheelchair in the office, and even if he has a horrific injury, he doesn't receive any weekly workers' comp income benefits. I had another client that had a finger injury. The injury wasn't severe enough to require surgery, but the employer couldn't accommodate his limitations. He couldn't grip and use his tools without his index finger. Mm-hmm. So he was getting the maximum rate in Georgia, which is $525 per week, even though he had a very minor injury. So it's all economic, and that's temporary totals when they're completely out of work. It does protect him. A lot of times I have a situation where I have an injured employee, and the doctor says, you need to work 4 hours a day instead of eight. Or mm-hmm. they have to do, you know, the big ones, truck drivers. You know, they're making good money, getting paid by the mile. They get hurt, and then they're cutting out paper dolls in the office, and they're getting $7.25 an hour. So temporary partial pays them for the difference in their income, or two-thirds of the difference. And that's another thing I think is kind of shocking to people, is you don't get your full pay when you're on workers' comp. What they do is they take the 13 weeks prior to your date of injury to calculate what's called the average weekly wage, and then workers' comp pays you 66 2/3% of that. Now, the first thing I hear is, oh, well, how am I going to get by on 2/3 of my pay? But it's based on their gross income, and it's tax-free, so it's not as significant of a reduction as it sounds like. And where a lot of people catch up is what's called the PPD benefits, or permanent mm-hmm. partial disability benefits. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of the work comp. It's not pain and suffering, but it's kind of I tell people it's the work comp version of it. So what that does is that pays them based on their percentage of loss of use of injury. And another thing people having an orthopedic injury don't realize is that you normally don't get it. Everybody gets used to, I get an infection, I take some antibiotics, I'm cured. I need my appendix out, I get it removed, I'm cured. Orthopedic injuries are very different. You typically don't get be 100% right. after one of those. And I've been through it myself, you know, different various injuries.
It's continual.
Yeah, and you're getting some deficit. Matter of fact, I was at a seminar put on by a group called the Houston Clinic that handles a lot of Southwest Georgia. It's kind of nationally famous. And one of the surgeons there explained it in an interesting way that I had not heard before. He said, when we do surgery for an orthopedic injury, what we're doing is we're basically re-injuring your body in a way to hope it heals better than it's healing on its own. So typically you're going to have some loss of range of motion, those sort of things.
Wow, yeah.
And so that's where the PPD benefits come in. And when an employee reaches what they call maximum medical improvement, they plateaued, or in other words, gotten as good as they're going to get, they assign that rating. And so it's not like people think or expect it to be. Often what I hear is, well, my back's only half as good as it was, so therefore I presume my rating's 50%. They use a textbook, and Georgia's still using the AMA Guides to Permanent Impairment, 5th edition. A lot of states have moved on to the 6th. The 6th is better for the employer. The 5th edition is better for the employee. So there's always a battle over that. But it's based a lot on range of motion, how much flexion, extension, abduction, and things have you lost. And there's a little bit of subjectivity in it. So a lot of times I have clients, and they may see several physicians, and each one of them is assigned a separate rating. But and so in order to do that calculation, legislature has broken our body parts down a number of weeks worth of checks. So what they call the body as a whole, which typically is the head and spine injuries, is 300 weeks. Your arms and legs are 225 weeks. Your hands, wrists, feet, and ankles are 160. They even go down to your pinky finger, pinky toes, 20 weeks. So in other words, your pinky toe gets chopped off. You get 20 weeks of checks.
That's so crazy.
Paid at the same rate you're paid when you're completely out of work. So to give you an idea how they do the calculation, let's say you get a 10% rating to the spine, which is 300 weeks. 10% or 0.1 times the 300 is 30 weeks. And you get 30 weeks of benefits. But those benefits aren't paid until you're not being paid for being out of work. So a lot of times I have a client with a significant injury that's out of work for, you know, years, and they're going to be owed this money, you know, sometimes up to, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. But they don't actually get paid that money until they're no longer receiving income benefits for being out of work.
I see. So they have to wait.
Correct. Wow. I tell them to think of it as a retirement account. Like, think of the work comp income benefits as your pay, and this is your retirement later. They can't access it if they file for what's called an advance. And it's a little bit of a hassle, but you have to file forms with the state indicating how what your income, monthly income is, where you're getting behind, and where you need to catch up. And typically, the employer's insurers will agree to that, and mm-hmm. they'll maybe ask for a small percentage. If it's, you know, they owe $12,000, they might be willing to pay $2,500. But you also got a situation where work comp's very different from tort. In a tort, you know, if you you get struck by lightning and die, your claim would survive you for your estate. Workers' comp's different. When you get struck by lightning, that's it. It's done. So, and sadly, that happens. I think I had 4 clients pass away in 1 year.
Wow.
Last year, the year before. So they never got paid that.
So. No. Are they able to use that for benefits for somebody else in their family or no?
No.
It's just gone.
It's just gone.
Wow.
Unless it's a death claim. And that, I guess I should mention that. Death claims pay the dependents.
Okay.
And they split, apportion it based on how many dependents there are. And a lot of times that can get tricky. The easy one is minor children with a spouse. Okay, the child gets half. The spouse gets half. But I've got several that are kind of odd where I've got children just barely adults but still living at home and not going to college and fully being supported. And there's a lot of and then that's a fact issue for the judge to decide.
Right. You explained that so thoroughly.
Thank you.
It's really awesome. I feel like I understand it way better than I did. And I don't know if that's a good it's a good thing for you. Anyway, I'll go to the next thing. What are the employer's responsibilities regarding workers' comp? And you talked about how they actually can find the employee something else to do.
Right.
What else is there?
Really none. And then people think that's strange. What I hear a lot is I have employees come and they have a minor injury or it ends up becoming worse later on. The employer really doesn't have to do anything. There's a one-year statute of limitation for the employee. So a lot of times what I hear is, oh, don't worry, we'll take care of you. And especially when I've got family members that are working for each other. Oh, don't worry, I'll take care of these bills. And then eventually they get to the point where they can't take anymore. And then a year's run and the employee doesn't get a break just because they told the employer about it. Something actually has to be filed within a year. But the typical situation is the employer probably should report it to the carrier. Give them an opportunity to see a physician. Again, none of this is legally required. Now, if you go to to a hearing, the judge probably isn't going to be happy with the employer that didn't file a report, didn't file with their insurance carrier, didn't make an opportunity to
help.
But now,
they don't have to.
They don't have to. Now, what they should do is they should have what's called, and the other responsibility is if they have three or more employees, they need to have workers' comp. It doesn't count for farms or domestic servants, but so they should have workers' comp coverage, and to their advantage, they should have what's called the posted panel of physicians, which most people have seen. The law determines it should be posted in a conspicuous place, although that's not defined, but typically a place where employees would congregate, break areas where you clock in, clock out. And in order for the employer's advantage, in order for it to be valid for them to limit the medical care, it needs to be six providers unaffiliated with each other, at least two industrial, or no more than two industrial clinics, and at least one orthopedic surgeon and one minority physician. So if they do that properly and explain it to the employee, they can limit the employee's medical care, and which is very big in workers' comp because the doctors rule these cases. What the doctor says goes, and especially in Atlanta, less so in the more rural parts of the state, but there are doctors all over the place. I see some, you could have the same employee, you got two doctors, one's got them on death's door, the other one says that there's nothing wrong with them.
Right,
so,
yeah.
And everything kind of flows from that, what medical treatment they can receive, what benefits they're entitled to, what their permanent, how high the rating is. So, but other than that, they're really, other than having coverage, there's nothing really that they absolutely have to do. And I always hear all the time, well, can they fire me if I'm receiving workers' comp? I mean, Georgia's pretty much employment at will. They can fire you. I think the famous quote in the courts is they can fire you for good reason, bad reason, no reason at all, as long as it's not a discriminatory reason.
Wow.
So that's the biggest issue I litigate is when an employee's on light duty and they're terminated.
Right, right. I'm sure there's some disgruntled, relationships, too. If somebody files workers' comp in the past and the employer is kind of, bitter. Does that happen? Or?
Oh, yeah. And kind of my own personal theory is a lot of people, when there's an injury reported, they feel like it reflects badly on them. And so because of that, it tends to get taken out. And I think there's always some cynicism in workers' comp. And because, you see the things on the news where the guy, getting workers' comp and they've got him cage fighting or bungee jumping or water skiing or whatever.
I mean, yeah.
And that's not, it doesn't happen as often as you think. But I think because of that, there's a belief that there's some suspicion anytime there's a workers' comp claim.
Sure, sure.
And I noticed that when I used to defend the employers and the insurance companies, I would go and I'd meet the employer and, I had a case where somebody fell off a roof. And they were a little cynical about that.
All right, Rich Casanova here. Talk to us about the employee going to the doctor. What's the requirements there? What's the expectations, I guess, sir?
Well, they can technically, the employer can send them for an evaluation only. And the law favors that, where they can just send them to whatever doctor they want without accepting the claim.
Right.
So what most people don't realize is an employer can pay for millions of dollars worth of medical treatment over years, but they haven't technically accepted the claim until they paid income benefits. But typically the employer should show the employee their panel. The employee can pick a physician, and that physician becomes authorized treating physician. And they can arrange referrals to specialists. They don't have to honor a referral of a referral. So in other words, if you go to a back doctor and he refers you to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist wants you to refer you to a neurologist, they don't have to honor the neurologist. But they are allowed one change to a doctor to another doctor on the panel unilaterally.
Who is the employee?
Their employee can make one change to another doctor on the panel. But after that, they're done, barring a motion filed with the state that's granted.
Right. And then at the end of the day, who's responsible for the medical bills?
The employer covers all the medical bills. They're responsible for anything the doctor orders. I've had unusual stuff ordered. I tried a case a couple weeks ago where they were seeking lawn maintenance. The lady had three back surgeries and was wheelchair bound. The doctor ordered them to take care of her house and to do her yard maintenance. So anything the authorized treating physician orders, they have to approve. I mean, I've had it where they've ordered the spouse or attendant care, but they also reimburse mileage, 40 cents a mile, whether it's going to the physical therapy, diagnostic tests, pharmacy, medical appointments, whatever.
And from a business perspective, we are business radio, right?
Right.
So for the employer, they have, I mean, does insurance and, generally cover all that? I mean, or that could, but, you know, some of these cases easily could bankrupt the business, put the business out of business, right?
Right. And that's what, and I had that happen with, and it was actually a case I got involved in later, but an employee was injured, the employer didn't have workers' comp coverage.
Right.
And the guy threw two fingers on his hand, amputated, right. His hand was messed up. And that gets to be very difficult because typically employers don't have a lot of, disposable income.
Right.
So when there's a major injury, those bills pile up.
Yeah.
And then what I think a lot of them don't realize, a lot of people don't want to have workers' comp because
right.
they don't want to pay the premiums, which can be high. So what they don't realize is they say, I'll just bankrupt the business. Well, there's a case out there, Samuel versus Bacher, that says you can sue the individual who was responsible for obtaining that coverage in what they call tort in a contract.
Right.
And so they could be personally responsible for those bills. Even though they had a company that was incorporated that was supposed to protect them.
Yeah, that's what I thought. You know, I thought it was LLC pretty much creates a buffer between you as the individual and the business.
And it's a little tricky because this is a separate tort action. So it's not necessarily a workers' comp claim at that point.
Right.
It becomes a separate action against that individual who's responsible for getting that coverage that they were, you know, legally required to get.
They just kind of follow wherever the money is available, right?
Yeah, for the most
many
part.
Times, yeah. I don't know if we have time on this, the appellate advocate position.
Yeah, I was going to ask that.
Well,
if you could explain a little bit more about that.
It's a little bit different in workers' comp than a traditional superior state court case or federal court case. When the judge makes a decision, these cases are tried in front of a single judge rather than a jury. So if somebody's unhappy, they appeal it to the appellate division, which they usually hear within 3 to 5 months. The appellate division, the standard of review is the big thing with these courts and different levels of appeal. So when you appeal from the administrative law judge to the appellate division, the standard review is it supported by the competent and credible evidence within the record. If it's a legal issue, in other words, they feel like the judge misapplied the law, that's usually the thing that's going to be really reviewed. A lot of people appeal just because they're unhappy, which I typically don't do because the judge has the discretion to weigh the evidence and determine whether they found the witnesses credible. And the case law bears that out. They said, well, typically the ALJ is in the best position, or administrative law judge is in the best position to make that determination. So I think a lot of these cases are appealed, but I believe the affirmance rate of the judge is about 92%.
Can you tell me about that case?
Singleton versus?
Yeah.
Okay.
2008.
That was a bus driver who was a school bus driver for the DeKalb County, and
mm-hmm.
she suffered an inhalation injury. She had pre-existing asthma, and her job
oh, wow.
was to drive the special needs bus. So at the end of the beginning of the school year, she goes to get on her bus, and the kids have vandalized it. They discharged fire extinguishers, and between that and the cleaning solvents and the spray paint and all that stuff, it triggered her asthma. And this was a big concern to her. She had like 12 brothers and sisters. One of them had died from asthma. Another one was permanently, basically incapacitated. So she goes and treats with the doctors, and the doctors say, well, yeah, you had a flare-up of this asthma, and you're going to be more susceptible to it now. You're okay now, but you're going to be more susceptible.
Mm.
And so her fear was that she was going to, that this was going to trigger another attack. They even told her cold weather was going to do it, which opening the bus, was definitely going to cause that. And she drove the special needs kids that she cared about, so she was kind of psychiatrically limited. And DeKalb wouldn't give her another job, and she begged for them to put her in the library or, let her do whatever else, and they wouldn't. So typically the two cases that address the psych claims, only deal with whether it's compensable. In other words, it can't be just because you're sad or upset, your spouse was mean to you or you're having money trouble. That stuff isn't covered. But if it's related to the physical injury in part, it is. But this was the first case where the physical condition had resolved, and it was just the psychiatric component that limited her from doing her job.
So you were able to fight for her.
Yes, yes.
And you won.
We won.
Awesome.
Made law. That was when I finally felt like a real lawyer. So.
Well, you do really good. And I'm telling you, like the way you explain things, I can hear your passion in it. And it's just very thorough. about it. And it just, it helps the, you know, just the general public understand. And, you know, even though I've been on the show for a year, I understand a lot more than
I think
the
pretty soon
public,
you'll get a honorary degree in law, right?
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know who would sign off on that, but yeah. Hey, I know we're almost, we're ready for our next guest, but just if you have just a second, a quick guest. So you have a colleague here joining you in the studio from Morgan & Morgan, right?
Yes. Angela. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Angela Caruso. I'm Rob's assistant.
Okay. And just, I had a quick question just from a business perspective. Again, I thought Morgan & Morgan, like you hear so many commercials here in Atlanta, but tell me a snapshot. They're outside this market, right?
Yep.
Around the country.
Yes, we're in several states.
Okay.
Our corporate office or our home office right. is in Orlando.
Okay.
And then we have the Atlanta office, and then Rob and I just moved down to Columbus and opened up the Columbus office.
But they're in quite a few markets. I looked on the website.
They're it's the largest plaintiff's attorney firm in the country.
Yeah.
Offices in Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, New York,
yeah, but the Northeast,
Kentucky.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because, you know, we hear it so often, the brand and the name, but it's beyond local. I mean, it's, like you said, the largest?
Yeah, it's the largest one in the world, actually.
Wow.
So they, I think they're opening offices in Canada, or they may already have, too. It's
wow.
200 and over 260 attorneys now.
Wow.
So how can our listeners yeah. reach you?
They can call me, my office in Columbus, which is area code 706-478-1949. They can get our website. It's very simple, forthepeople.com. And I always get the question, it's F-O-R, not the number four.
And, or if they don't own four, I'll buy that domain name then with the four, yeah.
And it's,
I'm sure there's no one would have a problem with that, yeah. I wouldn't get a call from anybody, yeah.
Or they can send me an email at rhendricks, R like my first name, Rob, Hendricks like my last name, spell like Jimi Hendrix with an X at forthepeople.com.
What'd you say, 200, how many, 200 attorneys?
200 million?
It's over 200,
oh,
over 260 attorneys now.
Oh, yeah, I guess between they could probably take the two of us, whatever, yes. You guys can keep the four with the number four, yeah. The people.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Angela.
And I do have to remind everybody, we're listening to Atlanta Legal Experts Radio, and I have a list of sponsors, which is awesome. It's Peachtree Offices, of course, 3A Law Practice Management, Atlanta's John Marshall Law School, U.S. Legal Support, Golden Pear Funding, and Equitable Payments. And they can all be found on AtlantaLegalExperts.com. And so we have another guest here today, David Windicher.
Good morning, Emily.
Yes, with the Windicher Firm.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you so much for being here this morning.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Emily. I'm grateful to be here and get to share my story. And thank you, Rich, for having me as well.
Absolutely.
I'm excited to share the story.
I'm excited, too. I'm absolutely excited. David Lee Windicher was admitted to the Georgia Bar in 2012 and the Florida Bar in 2014. He is a member of the Georgia and Florida Court of Appeals, the Georgia and Florida Supreme Court, the Northern District of Georgia United States District Court, and the American Bar Association. Windicher, the son of Argentine immigrants, spent his formative years residing in two of the most dangerous cities in the United States, El Monte, California, and Miami, Florida. Despite being born into desperate circumstances, surrounded by tough gangs and limited opportunity, David relentlessly fought to change his fate. Today, Windicher practices criminal defense at an Atlanta-based law firm, but then you've now become the Windicher Firm.
That's correct.
And is the founder of Red Ink, a nonprofit organization sponsoring GED programs for young juveniles facing nonviolent criminal charges and capable of rehabilitation through an education. He wrote an autobiography, The American Dream, His Story in the Making, to portray the difficulty of obtaining the American dream as an impoverished minority. Windicher's faith in God and love for his family were the catalyst for turning his life around. That's interesting, you know. It's just a little.
Just a little bit.
So tell me, you were raised in Miami, Florida, in an impoverished area. Tell me a little bit about that. What was that like?
Well, I grew up on the other side of white picket fence perfect. When people think Miami, they imagine South Beach. They think about the mansions, the yachts, the upscale dining, the high-end shopping. But that's just a small area there. The majority of Miami is actually very... It's a lower socioeconomic environment. I grew up in the grip of poverty. We were raised in Miami-Dade County where it was tough because when you grow up in an impoverished environment, those are tough neighborhoods. And mm-hmm. it was a task just to get home from school. And my dad, who was a boxer growing up all his life, had to teach me how to fight because I needed to find a way to make it home safe. In most affluent neighborhoods, the main decision after school is what we're going to have for dinner. My decision was which path to take home so I can make it home for dinner. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't easy, and poverty led me to become bitter and angry, and it just led me down a destructive path for quite a few years.
Yeah. So tell me, you eventually joined a gang in Miami. So what made you decide to do that?
There were a couple reasons. The biggest reason was poverty. I was angry about being poor, and a gang gives you means to income. So I joined the gang so that I could have three meals a day. I was excited about having three meals a day, and if selling drugs meant having three meals a day, that's what I was going to do. But on top of that, the other part was that I needed to do it for survival. I didn't have a choice. I lived in that neighborhood where it was saturated with gangs, and actually joining a gang was an integrated and expected part of growing up because you wouldn't have a choice. You had to pick a side. And I was Hispanic, and so I would walk home from school, and even though I knew how to box, kids would come and jump me, two or three of them at a time, and I can handle two or three of them at a time because I knew how to box. But after a while, they started sending 8, 9, 10 of them, and they would leave me bloodied. I mean, literally, there were times when I did not think I would survive. So I had to make a decision, and I needed to join a gang for the protection. I needed it for protection. I joined the gang out of necessity.
Protection, food, income.
That's right.
Which is what we all have on the other side of the fence. You know?
Right, pretty much. And those are bare essentials that most families in certain neighborhoods have, but we didn't have it. My family worked hard. I mean, I wasn't raised wrong. I was just raised in the wrong place.
Sure, sure. Yeah, they were working hard. That's why they taught you to how to get home from school. Your dad taught you how to get home from school because he was busy working for you.
Right. He was. We only had one car. They couldn't, you know, coordinate rides. I had to walk home from school, and he was working hard, blue-collar jobs just to provide for our family. Of a family of six, I was the oldest of four.
Wow. So is this why people normally join gangs?
Yes, out of necessity. People join gangs because it's not that it's a cool thing to do. When you grow up in these neighborhoods, you either choose to pick a side that will offer you protection, or you choose to be a statistic. And it's that simple. It's not because people want to be cool and join a gang and say they're in a clique. When it's a real tough neighborhood like that, it's not because it's cool to do. There's a lot of...
And that's what a lot of people think. You know, they think that they're just trying to be cool, and it's, you know, they love drugs, and they're just the wrong kind of people. But it's really not. It's a totally different
That's reason. Right. It's completely out of necessity. It's not because you want to be down with certain groups of people or things of that sort. You're just doing it because you want to live another day.
And you made this gang, kind of formatted it to make it so that you kind of had the right people around you, and you were kind of the leader. You wanted the respect that you needed to survive.
Right. It was myself and another individual, Joey Torres, who's my best friend growing up. He's incarcerated now, doing 15 years, 3 years left on his sentence. He couldn't get out. The reason we did that is because in those environments, you learn quickly that the only thing you can trust is what you can control. Mm-hmm. And we developed relationships with people that we grew up together as kids, and we had common needs. And because we had those common needs together, we kind of came together, and we decided that those common needs would be met by our actions. And we trusted each other. It was a small group. It was about 12 of us total. And, you know, we helped each other survive.
So what was it like in the gang? And were you ever arrested? Did you ever have to deal with the police?
I had several run-ins with the police.
Just a few.
13 arrests and over 7 months incarcerated. I had a lot of difficult times with police officers. They profiled us a lot because of the way we dressed or because of the way that the cars we drove, the things that we did allowed them to kind of profile us. And on top of that, in Miami-Dade County, law enforcement is not always up to snuff. I mean, a lot of the times, I can't tell you how many times I was beaten up by police officers, drug money taken from me, drugs taken from me, and no arrest, wake up with a concussion. And so, you know, it became a war between us and the cops.
You explain that in your book too, and we'll be talking about the book in just a minute. But yeah, that you just woke up later, didn't know what happened. You're in a field or something, and
that's right.
Had to figure out what happened.
Mm-hmm. I was, you know, up to no good, and a police officer. It took a little while for me to remember everything. I had to start remember like detailing back the facts in my head, and I'm thinking, what happened? How? Because I went through some beatings in my life being in a gang, some serious fights, and that was unlike anything I've ever experienced. I mean, I woke up with a serious concussion. I was throwing up. I couldn't barely move, and little by little, it started coming back to me. And I remember it was a police officer who did it.
Wow. So you got to learn a lot about the law, though, while you were doing this.
Oh, yeah.
A little foreshadowing there.
Going from defendant to defense attorney, the transition was there because of my 13 arrests and going through the procedures and just kind of understanding, you know, the lingo in the courtroom and how things are negotiated inside a courtroom. I spent a lot of time observing when I had the chances, and I had a lot of chances.
Were you treated fairly by the judicial system in the courtroom?
All I saw behind the shiny badge and the robes and the probation officers was corruption. The only reason I saw that is because the way I was treated by police. And then when I did have a case, the public defender was just trying to persuade me to cop a plea. And I just didn't feel like I could trust anybody. So it kind of gave me a bitter disposition about the system, because the worst thing that the system does is it incarcerates young children along with adults. When I was 17, I was charged as an adult on an aggravated battery where I had to retaliate for someone who attempted to rob me. And I ended up getting put in the Miami-Dade County pretrial detention center for 90 days. And this is where people are facing life. People are facing serious charges. And you should not be 17 years old in that environment, because you will come out a hardened criminal. Talk about PTSD and how that affects you and how you can adapt back to society coming out of there. I was fortunate that I only got 90 days. So the judicial system didn't do me any favors.
Was that your longest?
The longest I was incarcerated was 90 days consecutive. It was a total of a little bit over 7 months, but it was 90 days consecutive was the longest.
So what inspired you then to become an attorney?
A couple of things, my family and my faith.
Can I back up a little bit?
Sure.
Did you have faith during the time that you were young and growing up in the gangs?
My parents tried to raise me to be a man of God, but I was very angry at God. I felt that if God was real, why would he put any family or any one person in those type of circumstances? Why would anybody be subjected to poverty to that extreme? And so I didn't care to believe. I was angry with him. And it took me quite a while to understand why it was important. The key issue became, if not God and Jesus, then who? Because is there an alternative? And so when I started realizing that there was no alternative, and it was God, and it was Jesus, I needed to have more conviction in my faith. I started reading scriptures and going to church, and little by little, parable by parable, I developed my faith. And before you knew it, I started realizing that he gave me a purpose, and that this was God's plan. It was a preordained destiny, and I have now a voice for those who are similarly situated as I am. And I had to have the strength to go through those things to develop character and integrity and the type of dignity that you need in order to be a role model to those who are experiencing some of the same challenges. So God was huge for me, not at first, though. We started off with a really rocky relationship, but now we're solid.
That's good. Rich Casanova here, producer, engineer, Business Radio X. Man, just a lot of questions here for you. Have you been back to, I was born in Miami myself, and I know there's at least one other person here in the studio from Miami, but we were definitely a whole different life experience. Actually, maybe I actually decided to leave when I was 13 months old, so.
lucky you.
Yeah, apparently, yeah. Right. But have you been back there, or do you still have any family or friends there? And there are those two sides of Miami, like you talked about. Mm-hmm. Everybody does have this idea of South Beach, but how, you know, do you get back there very often? Or
I go back because my family is still living there, my mom and my dad and my brother specifically, and I'm working really hard to get them out of there because they're still in the same neighborhood where all this stuff happened. It's different because they're older. They're not part of the community in that sense. They don't need to walk to school and back.
Yeah.
But they're still there, and I'm not very happy about that, but I'm working on doing whatever I can to try to help them get out of there.
I mean, it is weird. I have friends in Detroit, and it's just kind of like that's just their world, and they don't really realize that there's so much more possibilities,
oh, yeah.
right, if they left that environment.
Right. And it's the center of their universe because it's all they know. And it's, you know, we're Hispanic. My parents didn't speak very good English growing up. And they speak English now, but it's a Hispanic community. So they kind of feel acclimated there.
Right.
And I wish they would know a little bit better. My two sisters, Giselle and Karina, actually left. They both live in San Diego now. They finished school and they moved on to San Diego. And I'm trying to encourage my family to either get out of there and move to either Atlanta or San Diego as well.
Now, back to this experience as a gang member, I mean, just as a civilian, is there some element at a certain point where you feel like this is becomes your family? I mean, you hear that quite often. It's like, for better or for worse, they kind of, they're brothers that support you or whatever, right? I mean, is that part of the experience or no?
The part of the gang that becomes difficult when you're in it that you don't see at the moment is that exactly there, because you become more loyal to your gang brothers than to your family. You start spending more time with them. You start doing more criminal things. And before you know it, it's an addiction.
Yeah.
And it becomes such an addiction that it's really difficult to get out of.
It's extremely almost like a self-adopted cult.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not, but...
There's a sense of substance that goes with it because you're providing for yourself. And on top of that, if your means of income are significant enough, you can provide for your family as well. So
it's hard to walk away from it.
Oh, it's so difficult to walk away from it. And then on top of that, being in gangs is a lot of fights, and walking away from it means that you may have to look over your shoulder.
There's no longer, it's not really an option.
Mm-hmm. I was in more fights after I got out than while I was in there.
You had to prove yourself even though you weren't in the gang.
Of course. As soon as people got word that I was no longer
You had all these people.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of retribution, and I basically flattened my knuckles from fighting after I got out of the gang.
I don't know if we have time for this. This could open up a whole Pandora's box here, but this issue of at the time that you were facing these police issues, obviously there's no technology, the smartphones. But fast forward to today, I mean, obviously you're more cognizant of what's going on in the political landscape along this line, but you see any solutions rather than just kind of dwelling on what's going on? I mean, what do you attribute all this to, the recent phenomenon?
I always say I'm trying to bring the Fourth Amendment back, because I think that the Fourth Amendment lost the thrust and the purpose of it. It's custody and seizure and search. And right now, the smartphones are actually helping the community develop a resolution. When I was growing up, the same things were happening. They just weren't being recorded because we didn't have those type of technologies.
People are more educated now because of the information that's out there.
And what I would tell to people who are being profiled, or they believe they're being profiled, is don't run, because at that point you become appearing to be guilty.
Sure.
But at the same time, know your rights. Understand how to assert yourself in a manner that a custody, a seizure, a search won't happen unless the police officer feels that they know that you know your rights and that they have probable cause or reasonable or articulable suspicion to go forward with a search. I mean, you asked me this. Can a police officer recite the Fourth Amendment? I guarantee you that there's not very many out there. It's a small percentage. And I'm not saying this that all police officers don't know their training or don't know their job, but if you have to read your Miranda warnings off of a card, you probably don't know the Fourth Amendment properly.
Yeah. Listen, I want to go back to basically transitioning from the gangster life to the attorney and going to law school. What was that like for you?
There was an adapting that took some time. The process was difficult because when you leave such an environment, there's a stigma that attaches, and it's a sentiment of feeling that you don't belong, that you're not good enough, that you shouldn't have this opportunity. And I had to fight that upward climb for quite a while. The most difficult part was that when I got there, the language was a lot different. You know, there's a lot of Ebonics and slang in the ghetto and the hood. And so I needed to understand how to properly assert myself and be eloquent and articulate. So that was one. And then on top of that, these people who are in law school, these fortunate individuals who get to go to law school, have been accustomed to suits, resumes, and proper etiquette all their life. I needed to literally watch YouTube videos on table etiquette so I did not feel at a place when I would go to some networking event. So there was a lot of tough adapting that I had to do. And I'm glad I had to go through it because it made me better.
Sure.
But it was not easy. I mean, it was tough to fathom going from selling dope to reading books and writing briefs.
I can't imagine it. I really can't imagine it. And there's a fear. I mean, there's a fear in what you were doing, but there's a new, this is a whole new thing for you. I mean, I can imagine that you had some fears with that too.
Absolutely. It took a long time for me to overcome the feeling that I didn't belong. I had to, my goal was repetition. I saw it as an opportunity to get better. I had nothing to lose, but an opportunity to gain. And the way I looked at it is school was very important. John Marshall's where I got into, but practical experiences were very, very important for me because I felt like I was behind the eight ball, so to speak. I was 30 when I got to law school because of my experiences. So I was a little bit behind and I needed to go out there and get practical experiences. I needed to find a way how.
What was it? Was it difficult getting into law school?
It was extremely difficult. I applied.
With your criminal history and everything.
Yeah. What I did was I went, everybody has to go through the law school's admissions council. And then I got a fee waiver because, you know, I was impoverished. So I applied to literally like 50 schools and every single one of them denied me. Two of them actually has showed some interest and it was Georgia State and John Marshall. I ended up having to do long statements of intent. I ended up needing to come and do personal visits and kind of show why I was not of a victim of circumstance. It was just a circumstance that I did not feel like I was a victim and I got better out of it. I didn't want to project that, oh, look, I could have done better, but I decided I didn't want to do better. So now when I realized that this was an opportunity that I needed to really take on, I went to see people in person and talk to them to show them that I was of the character fit to practice law.
That's incredible.
It's a very inspiring story. I know we're going to talk about the book in just a moment, but talk to us about Red Ink, this nonprofit. What and you're sponsoring juveniles, the GED programs?
Right, that's correct. Red Ink is the DBA doing business as for a rehabilitation enables dreams. Red was obviously my name growing up because of my hair.
Yeah, for our radio listeners, yeah, he's definitely got the red hair, yeah.
Right, and so Red Ink became the name, and what we do is we sponsor the GED programs, and the reason why we do that is because I am not unique. I am not one of a kind. There are so many like me out there, and what I'm trying to do is get my hands on them to try to help them get onto higher ground. What I'm doing is finding nonviolent youthful offenders and trying to mentor them to understand that there is hope. If they're living in the grip of poverty, if they don't have a family structure, if they don't have the means to get there, we're trying to push them. And I'm working with DeKalb County and Fulton County, and we're trying to do whatever we can to help these kids because, as I said earlier, the difficulty of adapting to a society without a reentry program when you're incarcerated is extremely difficult. And at that point, recidivism is more than likely.
I mean, it's a sad fact that, like you said, you're not, you know, just one case scenario. But I mean, it's not just inspiring; it almost gives me chills just imagining the struggles you went through. I mean, 50 no's, and that you still persevered. Mm-hmm. But I totally respect your mindset that you don't consider yourself a victim. I mean, to be, just to make that acknowledgement and just to achieve that point, I mean, that would, to me, is life-changing.
A lot of the other people that are in that situation.
Right, and the reason why I feel that way is because I realize that that is the case. My situation became an advantage to me. Mm-hmm. My disadvantage, which was perceived as a disadvantage then, became an advantage. It taught me how to work hard. It taught me how to hustle. If there's one thing that I learned going through this entire process is that no one has more potential than the person who starts from the very bottom, period. And so I'm not a victim. I was given leverage.
Right.
I just didn't see it that way back then when I was going through those struggles.
People always complain about their circumstances and what they're going through. And that should be what, like he said, what drives you to do better. Or, you know, it's not, your character is not your circumstances. It's who you are and what your choices are.
Exactly. It doesn't matter where you start. It matters what you do along the way.
Absolute takeaway from this interview. Let's talk about the book now.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more. I'm like, why did you decide to write the book?
The reason I decided to write the book is because I started out in a situation where I didn't know if I was going to get barred. And the reason I decided to write the book is because during law school, I was an intern for Manny Arora. And it was a great experience. I mean, fantastic. And he told me, listen, you need to go and try to get into the DA's office. That'll help you out when you go ahead and apply to the bar. And so I did. I went to the bar, to the DA's office in DeKalb, and I was hired. There wasn't a background search done on me because I believe that my resume spoke for itself, being that I was with Manny Arora. And so a little bit later, they realized that I had a situation of 13 arrests and some history. And so I was asked to leave my position. A couple of days after that, I spoke with Chief Investigator Scott over there, and he said that the district attorney, Mr. Robert James himself, wanted to speak with me. And so a couple of days after that, I went to go see Mr. James, and he told me he's watching my situation from afar. He wanted to see how I was going to respond to me being asked to leave the position. And he said that he called me the American dream. He said, you grew up impoverished. You know, you went through so many difficult situations. You went through the system, and now here you are. And he was a man of God, and we recited a prayer together, and he asked me to come back and join them. And that's it. That's when I knew I needed to share my story, because if there's somebody else out there that's just like me, and there are others, as I said, I want to do whatever I can to give them hope and inspire them to push as hard as they can, no matter what the circumstance.
So for our listeners, obviously we're going to post all this information on the site, and we'll ask you later in a minute how to get in touch. But tell us the title of the book, and what's the takeaway without giving away the ending, I guess. We kind of know the ending. You're here today.
Right. Atlanta Legal Expert.
Well, or this chapter of your life, yeah.
These types of stories usually have a sad ending, and this one does have a happy ending, in fact. The book's name is The American Dream, History in the Making. It can be found on Amazon, or it can be found on my book's website, hisstoryinthemaking.com. The book itself, to me, is something that I'm very proud of, because now with that book being published, I have the means to fulfill the purpose and the mission of Red Ink. And it's a blessing to be able to do that, because I do want to help the next person up. And like I said, we're already taking the initiative. We're in place to do that. So I'm really excited. We just published on May 21st, and on Amazon we're listed as number one new release under biographies.
Wow.
Which is great. And, you know, we just need to keep pushing and getting the word out there that the book is out, and hopefully people will keep buying it. But we've been doing really well for the last month.
And the portion of the book goes to Red Ink, correct?
Correct. Proceeds from the book go to Red Ink, and what I do is I take those funds and I donate them to DeKalb or Fulton or wherever I have a youthful offender that can't afford a GED program.
And what were your feelings when you finished the book? Because you told me yesterday it took you 4 years.
Mm-hmm. It was a sense of accomplishment, because it took so long that I never saw the end. I could have kept writing. I mean, there are so many more stories that are not in there. It details the 13 arrests. It details how I rehabilitated myself. It details how to go to law school as an impoverished minority. And it details how difficult it is to be barred in a state where you have 13 arrests, which is, I don't want to give the full book away.
Yeah, no, don't do
that. But it ends where, you know, I said I was charged as an adult. I ended up swearing into the Florida bar in the same courtroom place where I was being charged as an adult and facing 15 years.
And how long has the book been out?
The book's been out since May 21st.
Oh, wow.
Mm. You're brand new.
Well, kudos and congratulations, obviously, on that. And I'm sure somebody's already asked you this, but I got to ask you as well, and you'll get a few more movie deals in the making. I mean, this definitely,
when I read it, I thought this is a movie. I did not realize, I mean, I knew it was real, but I just couldn't fathom it. So when I met you, I was like, wow.
Right.
It's really real.
I really hope it's in God's plan to do that, because I think we'll be able to reach more people that way. My first, order of business, if we do get to a movie, would be to fulfill Red Ink more.
Right.
And just recently, we actually signed a shopping agreement, which gives Tyler Perry Studios the exclusive rights to shop it for a possible movie. They have to get a writer in place, a budget, a proposed cast, things of that sort. I'm not sure exactly what goes on behind those scenes, but I know that I do have a contract, and God willing, it turns into something.
Wow. Well, you're right in the middle of... what do we call Hollywood of the South here, or Hotlywood?
I've never heard that one before.
Yeah, I just made that up. Hotlywood. Mm-hmm. Well, there's Bollywood, there's Hollywood, there's Hotlywood.
So, can you tell me a little bit about the Windeter firm?
Sure. Recently, I started the firm because when the book published and a couple other things that started coming together for me created a situation where I needed to have my own schedule. And I'm grateful for what Manny Arora and Michael Escala have done for me because they mentored me, and these are fantastic attorneys. But my schedule became so restrictive with, you know, doing appearances for the book and doing things that are conducive to projecting Red Ink in the direction that I wanted to be. And so I had to start my own firm, so I created my own schedule. I practice here at a Buckhead in Atlanta, and I do criminal defense, any misdemeanors or felonies. I've been handling that since I started, and you know, I kind of feel like I have a little bit of experience from the 13 arrests, and so I stuck with criminal defense, and naturally became something that I fell in love with doing.
Can you talk about a case where you've rehabilitated somebody?
I've had plenty of cases where I would tell people through letters in jail, stay in communication with them. One girl in particular, I don't want to say the name, but I'm so proud of her. She was charged several times with difficult charges in different jurisdictions, and she ended up having to serve some time. During the time that she served, we exchanged letters, and she moved away from here because this is where all the problems were happening to her, and now we stay in contact. She's off on the West Coast. She's in school. She has a job, and she's put it behind her, and we always talk about it, and, you know, I always say if I can save one, it's worth it, and it is, but I'm going to try to save as many as I can, and I'm so very proud of her for having changed it and turned it around.
I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. What a great way to start the day hearing these stories. I know we just got a few minutes left. I don't know if Rob or anyone else in the studio has a question, or we want to maybe go around and remind our listeners the best way to get in touch with our guest here this morning. But Rob, can you imagine going through that and where you're at today? I mean, it's hard to even fathom, right?
Yeah, and I see that with a lot of my own clients. I see are usually injured because they are doing labor jobs.
Right.
They're doing labor jobs because they didn't have an opportunity to break through that. So my wife and I are always discussing that, how you get stuck in this socioeconomic rut, and it's very difficult to break out. So hearing this, my first thought is I wish I would have had a tax attorney after me so I didn't get upstaged. But that's great to hear. This is the kind of story I could share with my clients that are growing up in the rough areas of, you know, these towns like Columbus and Albany, as they say it down there.
Albany.
But I guess the biggest thing I'm wondering is who is going to be cast to play him in the movie.
Right. I have no idea.
Not just Conan O'Brien, I hope. Yeah.
Not Conan O'Brien.
Shooting for McConaughey.
I'm trying to McConaughey.
Yeah,
cool.
I could see that, yeah.
But
I'd say John Goodman, but
as long as they give me a cameo, I don't even care.
Right, yeah.
Just give me a cameo. Let me be the judge or
something.
Yeah,
there you go. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, yes, we'll just go ahead and remind everybody how to reach you and how to find the book one more time. And then,
okay. I can be reached on the website, which is windagefirm.com. The book can be found on Amazon by searching my name or the title of the book, The American Dream, History in the Making, my name being David Lee Windager. And there's also a website for the book, hisstoryinthemaking.com.
And it's WINDECHER.
That's correct.
Those people that are listening.
People can follow me also on Twitter at David Winicher. That's my handle, David Winicher. I have several social medias out there.
And you'll have all this on Land Legal Experts website as well. And
yes.
Rob, remind our listeners the best way to reach out to you.
They can call me on my direct line, area code 706-478-1949. They can email me at rhendricks@forthepeople.com or link my biography at forthepeople.com.
Have you had that phone number since 1949 or no?
Nah, afraid not.
Well, thank you both of you for being here. Two great stories, two great attorneys, and we're just excited for this episode and be able to publish it everywhere so that we can get the word out on the book and on your practice as well at Morgan & Morgan. So thanks for listening. This is Emily Rowell with Peachtree Offices signing out.